featuring interviews and commentary from Animal Rights Zone, the online social network for humans who seek justice for other animals. You can find us on the web at www.arzone.net. I'm your host, Carolyn Bailey. In today's episode, Tingara and I will be joined by animal activist, vegan, and creator of still and moving images, Carol Orzechowski. Carol, a long-time advocate for social justice causes, has recently produced and directed a full-length documentary focusing on vivisection. Maximum Tolerated Dose presents accounts of experimentation on other animals from the perspectives of the humans who have performed it, as well as of the other animals who have survived it. Carol and the MTD team were the recent recipients of the Lush Award in London and are aiming to have MTD prepared for TV distribution and a DVD release in 2013. Carol, thank you for being here today and welcome to AR Zone.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really, really looking forward to speaking with you both. I've been a fan of the podcast and the website for a long time.
Thanks, Carol. I've had the opportunity to see your new film, and it's unlike any other I've seen on the subject at all. Could you please tell our listeners why you thought it was necessary to create Maximum Tolerated Dose?
Well, the film actually came more out of a personal sort of journey than it did out of an activist motivation. I mean, obviously I made the film because I wanted to, you know, make a contribution to the movement in that way, but really the idea for the film came about because of two sort of chance meetings that I had with people who had been a part of the vivisection industry and then had left that industry. And when I met those two people who were both in the film, I hadn't really thought of that perspective of people who had done those things and then had left for ethical reasons. I mean, obviously I knew that those people existed, but I had never met them myself. And so hearing their stories firsthand was really powerful for me. And that was sort of where the motivation for the film came about. And I mean, of course, after I started making it, I realized that it does. I mean, it's a film that does have activist implications, and a lot of my work, you know, deals with, as you said, social justice issues, and so it kind of makes sense that that's what it would be used for. But the motivation for it really, really came from that sort of personal contact that I had with those people.
It's really interesting what you say about how we don't see the perspective of other people like that. I think that's quite a common thing. In the intro, I mentioned that Maximum Tolerated Dose had won the Lush Prize in London. Can you please speak about what the Lush Prize is and what it meant to you and to the film?
Well, the Lush Prize, I mean, I don't want to speak on behalf of Lush too much, but, you know, from my perspective, I was really excited when I heard about the Lush Prize because, you know, I really do think that when it comes to animal experimentation, you know, the shift away from it is going to be, it's going to take place on numerous fronts. It's an issue that's not simply consumer driven. It doesn't really matter. Oftentimes, it doesn't really matter what consumers do with their money when it comes to university research that happens involving animals. Individual consumers can't do a whole lot. And so what really excited me about the Lush Prize was that they had this sort of multifaceted approach. They wanted to, you know, give out funding to people who were fighting animal testing on different fronts. And we were nominated in the public awareness category, along with some activist groups, an author, Andrew Knight, who has written a book about alternatives to animal experimentation, and we were selected for the prize. And I mean, first of all, I was surprised that we made the shortlist, and I was even more surprised when we were, you know, included among the finalists. And it's funny, you know, sometimes people, when I'm doing interviews like this, they say, you know, Carl is the, you know, he runs Decipher Films. And I mean, that's like a nice turn of phrase, but really Decipher Films is like what happens on my desktop computer and on my on my laptop computer. It's not like a it's not a studio with a big budget and all, you know, all of this stuff. It's just a name. And so we made the film on an extremely tight budget. Much, you know, there's a couple of film funding bodies in Canada, and our budget is like a fraction of what they consider to be even a micro budget film. So, getting the prize was in a lot of ways a really big boost to us. Not only financially, it's going to help us with the DVD release, but, also just like as a show of support, it's really nice to know that this thing that we've poured a lot of energy into has been recognized in that way.
So let me ask, I'm not interested in the specific numbers, of course, but you mentioned that you produced the film on a shoestring, or I guess I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounded like you were saying more or less on a shoestring sort of budget. It does take a lot of resources though to produce. I mean, I've watched the film as well, and it's just, you know, it looks as good as anything that you'd see in a movie theater. It doesn't look like something that was produced on a shoestring. So when you're talking about a low budget type film like this, it still takes a lot of money to do this, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm, sure. I mean, I don't necessarily mind talking about numbers, and I think in some ways it helps to sort of demystify what goes into making a film. I think, you know, I mean, I can't discuss numbers of other films, but essentially we raised about $15,000 through donations. Yeah. So we had sort of an ongoing, similar to like a Kickstarter campaign, although we didn't use the Kickstarter platform for it, you know, where we offered people rewards and so forth. So we raised about $15,000 that way, and I contributed probably about $5,000 in personal funds, and we also received a grant from the Canada Council for the Arts for about $18,000. So it was under $40,000 to produce the film, and that includes that includes everything. That includes the travel. That includes I own my own equipment, so I also own my own editing equipment. So at the same time, I know that some people hear that number and they say, well, you know, 30 some thousand dollars is still a lot of money. But I mean, that's, you know, you're including things like, I mean, I was, you know, editing the film for 6 months straight, and that included my like living expenses and things like that. So, I mean, it's not a lot of money, but it is a lot of money at the same time. And so, you know, when you think about that kind of money, say going into an advertising campaign, you know, you can buy a lot of Subway ads for that. You buy a lot of, you could buy, you know, maybe a few magazine ads for that. That would, you know, raise awareness about that issue as well. Or you could, you know, you could pay one person's salary at like a large animal rights organization for a year. You know, it's not an insignificant amount of money, but it is in the film world. It is a shoestring, and I'm actually quite happy to talk about it with people, because I think it's the film world is very like, I don't think, you know, we hear about these multi-million-dollar projects, but we don't really know where that money goes. Like, when you see a movie on screen, you know, people waste an incredible amount of money when producing films, and that's something that we just don't have the luxury of doing.
Yeah, I can imagine. The production values of the film are great, and you had I think interesting and I guess, and it was original music, or at least some of it was, you know, but no one, I mean, maybe they did, but you wouldn't expect that people work for free, right? I mean, you know, you may have been able to or wanted to contribute what you contributed because it was something that was, you know, for artistic reasons, and for other reasons, it was something that you wanted to do. But other people do have to get paid. And so I think sometimes in the in the broader movement, there's a sense that if people aren't doing the work that they do free of charge, that somehow it lessens the the authenticity of what they're doing. And I think that's sort of unfortunate that there seems to be an undercurrent like that I hear sometimes when talking with people in the movement, that somehow it's illegitimate if you have to raise money in order to do your advocacy, that somehow you're doing something wrong, as if you can like you said, I mean, if somebody takes out subway ads on a transit system in a major city, you could spend $40,000 in no time at all, and the money has to come from somewhere.
Easily.
So, yeah,
very easily. And I mean, when you look at larger animal rights organizations, I mean, they don't pay people a lot. People get paid much more in the private sector, but people need salaries and that kind of stuff is you have to account for that. I mean, everybody on the film. Who worked on the film was paid in some form or another. The people who were probably paid the most fairly were the people who composed the music, the people who helped with post-production, like sound mixing and mastering. And I had a second editor come in towards the end of the film to help sort of polish it up. And, and the people who helped to shoot some of the stuff were paid, and and I mentioned like at times like some of the budget went towards living expenses, but I mean I also work commercially as a photographer and as a videographer, so I was often sort of subsidizing the film through my own income, and I think in a perfect world, yeah, people would be able to get paid to do advocacy work, and I was able to at times not do commercial work and focus on the film using the very small budget that we had. But that's also because my lifestyle is quite stripped down. I don't have a very lavish lifestyle, so it's possible for me to stretch that budget as far as it'll go. And I mean, yeah, people who did work on the film during production worked at a rate that was, I mean, I would consider it an honorarium, not so much a salary, it's kind of, in the actual film industry, they would probably have been paid much more.
The film doesn't contain any graphic footage of experiments on other animals, and also very little footage that shows the impact of those experiments. I was a little bit hesitant that it would, as I expect probably most people would, just based on the fact that it's a film on vivisection. Was it your intention to make the film easier for people to watch in order to reach as broad an audience as possible? And if so, do you think that maybe a downside to not showing graphic footage may be that people think the problem of vivisection is not quite as real?
I think vivisection is kind of interesting in terms of what we think about it and how we think about it, in that I think that when it comes to animal experimentation, I think that people's imagination, people can imagine it as bad as it is. When you think about factory farming, or when you think about different uses of animals, oftentimes like the propaganda that we've been given for such a long time leads us to believe that things aren't as bad as they are, but animal experimentation has always been this kind of sort of opaque world where I think we're often left to our imagination to think about what goes on with animals, even when it comes to, groups like the Foundation for Biomedical Research, who will put out propaganda that makes it seem like, animals are great laboratory heroes. But I think when we, when we try to imagine what they go through, I think often our imagination matches the reality. And so it wasn't my intention to kind of go about doing the film in this kind of like horror show way. Earthlings is already a film that exists in the world. I think that it's employed graphic footage to its sort of maximum effect and use, and I think that and I think it does an excellent job of that. And so I didn't feel like I needed to repeat that. I also do quite a bit of editing of animal footage for my own projects and for other groups. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I don't want to, you know, I wanted to do something different. I also just wanted to make an, you know, I consider myself an animal rights activist, but I also, like, I consider myself a filmmaker first, and I didn't really want to make a quote-unquote animal rights film. I think what I wanted to do is make a documentary about animal experimentation, but I think this sort of genre of animal rights films is not something that I have a whole lot of artistic interest in. I have a personal investment in that kind of filmmaking, but I don't have an artistic investment in it.
I agree with you. I was actually a little bit scared to watch it, to be honest, because I steer clear of graphic footage, particularly when it's something that I've seen before, and I don't see a purpose to myself watching things like that, because I think that it just makes me and makes other people angry and kind of it's not productive. So I thought the film was fantastic on for many reasons, but I think that it will certainly have a much broader reach the way that you've approached it.
I really appreciate that, and I also appreciate, Tim, what you said about the production value, because that to me was a very, very high priority, to have the film look professional. And that's not to say that other animal rights films don't look professional. They do. And, you know, depending on the film, you know, every film has a different feel to it. And, you know, different feels and different looks, you know, have different effects. And I just wanted it to be, to me, the production value was really important, because I wanted it to be, as you said, you know, sort of indistinguishable from another film in the that you might see in a theater. I wanted it to be able to have that potential to exist in that space as well, not just on YouTube or not just on a DVD at home.
In an interview that was published on the blog Striking at the Roots, you said, "I believe very strongly that too many activists spend too much time reading things that they already agree with. It does nothing to sharpen their skills or expand their breadth of understanding." I agree with you about that 100%, and that's really sort of, if we, you know, we could take that, we could use that as the defining mission of AR Zone, to read things that you don't agree with, so that you can understand.
And I've read many things I don't agree with on AR Zone, and I appreciate that.
So, the question I have about the movie, is that you didn't include the voices of people who support animal experimentation, and I think I know the answer, because I don't think you're making that sort of film. But can you talk about why you didn't do that?
Yeah. So, and that's actually a really good observation. I think probably on the surface it seems like a contradiction, and maybe it is in some ways, but I don't really like, just personally as a filmmaker, I don't really like the sort of like the dialectical style of documentary filmmaking, you know, where you have like, but where you sort of portray some people on one side and then, you know, cut to some footage and then you portray like an opposite opinion. I don't ever really think that there are only two sides to an issue. And I think that when we frame issues as like, you know, we have this opinion over here and then we have this other opinion over here, it ends up sort of being very polarizing, and it doesn't really do justice to the issue. And, you know, you'll see that a lot in, you know, Michael Moore films or something like that, where it's very kind of like debate focused. So I didn't want to make a film that was a debate film. To me, the focus of the film was always about intimate stories. And I see, you know, filmmaking as a storytelling art, not a forum for debate. So I wanted to feature these stories in a way that honors the stories and that doesn't dilute them with a whole bunch of other stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I really do think that we learn a lot more from people that we disagree with than people that we agree with. But the interesting thing about the people in the film is that I think we, you know, meaning animal rights folks, I think we all did disagree with them at one point, and they disagreed with us. And their stories in the film are about that shift, about going from one place to another, not necessarily from one side to another, because not all of the people in the film are now animal rights activists. But they did have an ethical shift, and their stories in the film are about that journey and not so much about, you know, just telling us why, you know, why they don't like animal experimentation anymore.
So that's interesting, because I think the film portrays the people that you interviewed sympathetically. I mean, not overly so, but I think you showed them as people who were struggling with some things. I think that you could feel that they thought that, or they felt that some of what they had been doing was wrong, but they resigned themselves to doing it, or maybe that they felt that it was required of them by the system that they had chosen to work in, and I assume that they chose to work in that field because they thought it was a good thing to do, and they saw that, you know, they saw this part of what they had to do as a necessary evil. So I'm wondering, and I guess you've already said that, did some of the people believe that they had to do some of the things they had to do because the benefits to humans are so great that it excuses or justifies the harms that are done to other animals? And you mentioned Andrew Knight a minute ago in response to another question. We've interviewed him on ARZone a couple of times, and I'm wondering, do the people that you interviewed talk about the efforts to find new ways to do these experiments that don't involve other animals?
Well, one of the things that I sort of steered clear of in the film, as you probably noticed, is that I didn't really talk about science a whole lot. I mean, it's a film that's about the culture of science in a lot of ways, but I don't really get into sort of, you know, what are the alternatives and that sort of thing. And part of that is because you know, I'm not a scientist, and I don't feel on my best footing sort of discussing those issues. Dr. John Pippin, who's in the film, who he's done a lot of work with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. When I interviewed him, we discussed alternatives a fair bit, but none of that ended up getting into the film because it wasn't really... it just wasn't, I mean, not that, of course, research alternatives are relevant to the discussion, especially when you're, you know, discussing the ethical implications of experimentation. But at the same time, you know, research alternatives are not really relevant to these stories. The stories are very personal and very, emotional in a lot of ways. And, I think all of the people in the film thought that they had to do what they were doing. They didn't necessarily, I think that they felt that way to varying degrees at different times, but I think all of them felt like they had not necessarily an obligation, but it was part of their, it's part of their story. I don't think anybody, you know, in a lot of activism that's done around animal experimentation or any animal issue, really, there's a lot of anger and a lot of a tendency to paint people as sort of evil people. But I don't think anybody in the story that they have in their head about why they're doing what they're doing thinks, like, I'm an evil person, and I'm going to do these bad things because I just love being a bad person. I don't think anybody, if we're honest with ourselves, I don't think anybody thinks of themselves that way. You know, maybe an exception here and there, but generally speaking, I think everybody thinks that they're doing what they're doing because they're trying to do something good. And I just think we, you know, to be fair to the people who were interviewed, and to allow them to tell their stories in a way that was as honest as possible, I needed to extend that compassion to them and to be able to say, like, I want to hear your story honestly, not because I want to condemn you, but because I'm genuinely interested in your journey. And one of the things that most people don't know about the film is that everybody who's interviewed in the film was given, in the film industry, you give people these release forms. It's called like a release form, and you give them to them, and it has, you know, various, it's a contract essentially that says, you know, my film and company has the right to use your image from this interview recorded on this date in any form, and blah blah blah. Essentially, they're signing over the rights to use their face and use what they say however I see fit. And that's something you need to get to protect yourself legally. And I give everyone in the film a final right of refusal. And I did that. I felt confident doing that because I knew that nobody would have a problem with how they were portrayed. That I would portray them fairly. You know, what you said, you know, the film is sympathetic, but it's not overly sympathetic. I don't think I'm, you know, quote unquote, like, giving anyone a pass, but I think that, you know, I allow people to tell their stories in a way that's open. And interestingly, you know, it was kind of an experiment. I said, you know, here's the release form. You don't have to sign it until you've seen the final version of the film. And everybody signed it. I had no issues with anybody. And I consider all of the people in the film friends to a degree as well. I mean, I think in the making of the film, you know, they shared a lot with me, and you know, I listened, and a lot, you know, many of us are still friends now.
One of our members asked about this sort of aspect of the work that you did in the film, and how you take a non-adversarial approach to the people and to the subject matter generally. And I guess maybe it's really not fair to say that the film is a film about vivisection, because it's really about the people that live through that system, and of course the non-human animals that live through it as well. But when you think about that non-adversarial approach, is there a lesson that you hope that people that, you know, that take, you know, so, you know, the so-called take it to the streets, this combat mentality, the, all, you know, the militantistic sort of in-your-face confrontational approach, where, you know, people will go on home demos and say things to a physician's children and that sort of thing. I mean, are you hoping to reach those activists and maybe call into question the sort of activism that they do?
You know, I didn't make the film with the intention of sort of giving a strategic blueprint, and I definitely, you know, I hope that the film can be a resource for activists, but I don't know that it necessarily. The film was never, I didn't create it with the intention of questioning how different activists do their work. And, you know, I consider myself an on the streets activist, and I've done silent vigils. I've done home demos. Like, I understand that different emotions and different strategies motivate different kinds of activism. I think that, you know, home demos have their place, and I think that more quote unquote like confrontational activism has its place. I guess I just, when people talk about films as non-adversarial, it always kind of, I've just never thought of filmmaking as like an adversarial practice. I don't understand why I would want to have someone in a film if I don't care about what they have to say. You know, like I certainly understand the value in having people on camera and asking hard questions and that sort of thing, but I think in a lot of ways that's the place of journalism, and this isn't journalism. This is, to me, this is much more akin to storytelling, and I'm not interested in being someone's judge. So to me, like the whole, like, the film's very, like, many people have said this to me, the film's not adversarial. And I was like, well, that's not what I do. Like, I'm not going out to make enemies. Like, I'm interested in telling stories, and that to me is sort of the bottom line of filmmaking. You know, different filmmakers approach things differently, different activists approach things differently. But to me, it's not like, I'm not trying to fight anybody. You know, I really genuinely want people to have the space to share what they've been through. And not only that, I want, you know, the people in the film who I think tell the most, in some ways, the most compelling stories about the animals who have survived in labs are the people who worked with them. Like, you know, Rachel Weiss, who's in the film, who was a lab technician and a lab worker for a number of years, you know, worked with all different kinds of non-human animals, worked with birds, worked with, you know, rats and mice, worked with monkeys, worked with chimpanzees. I mean, her story about Jerome, the chimpanzee that she worked with before she finally gave up the practice. I mean, to me, her story is her story, and by extension, Jerome's story. You know, they're the most powerful stories in the film, and if I approached her as an enemy as opposed to someone who has something to share, that story would just be lost. So, to me, the approach is kind of a no-brainer, but I also understand why. I understand why activists do the kind of work that they do, and I know that, you know, home demos and the kind of, you know, public shaming of people comes out of a place of anger, and I feel that anger too. You know, I've been that angry activist at different times, and I will be that angry activist still in the future, but that wasn't what the film was about.
So you I can't speak for other people, but my sense from, you know, from talking. Yeah. Well, my sense from talking to people online, and talking to people online is sort of a strange environment in the first place. But talking with people online, you get the sense that some people think that if you call yourself an animal activist, then you have to be an animal activist in a certain way all the time, you know? So mm-hmm. I'm wondering, have you gotten any feedback from people who have criticized you because, you know, you were somewhat sympathetic to these people, and you did present them as like real human beings who struggle with, you know, these sorts of questions, where it wasn't a, you know, you didn't present like a one-sided, you know, these people are evil and what they're doing is wrong and it has to stop. I mean, I think that message comes through, but it isn't, you didn't create an in-your-face sort of propaganda piece. And have you had people tell you that you should have?
You know, I haven't had people tell me that, but I have, you know, I mean, as I was making the film, I follow different campaigns and I follow different, you know, I keep up to date on what's happening with activism all around the world, and I know that, you know, different campaigns have a different sort of tenor to them. I was listening to this podcast recently that they said something really interesting. They were talking about the debate between Chris Hedges and the Occupy movement. And Chris Hedges wrote this piece where he was talking about, you know, the black bloc activists and how they're the cancer of the Occupy movement. And you know, people who support black bloc tactics were understandably pretty upset with what he had written. And so they had this debate. You know, an anarchist group in the U.S. debated Chris Hedges, and it was a pretty interesting debate. You know, no matter what side of that argument you're on. And anyways, I was listening to this podcast where they were discussing this issue, and one of the people in the podcast said, you know, like we live in a complicated world, and we live in a world with a lot of people that we disagree with, and like, you know, when we talk about things like revolution, like we need to recognize that if we take these like romantic notions of confrontation to their logical conclusion, it's like we're either going to learn to live in the world with the people that we disagree with, or we're just going to kill them. And I don't think anybody really wants that. Like I don't think any activist, no matter how angry they are, wants a world where, you know, the quote-unquote other side is just like wholesale slaughtered. Like, is that what our intention is? And if it's not, then, you know, we need to learn to live with people that we disagree with. And I mean, maybe that's kind of getting away from the point, because the people who are in the film, like, I didn't disagree with them anymore. They've already sort of, they've gone through this ethical struggle and they've had this experience, and now they see things differently than they did. You know, throughout the process, Rachel Weiss, who I mentioned before, she for a long time ran this online support group for laboratory workers, both present and past. And one of the things that you probably noticed at the end of the film is I have a couple of, you know, sort of title cards that come up at the end that say, you know, if you are a current or former lab worker and you want to tell your story, like, please reach out, and we'll make the website for the film a forum for people to tell those stories. One of the people in the film who I speak with, they were actually still an animal researcher at the time that I interviewed them. And they contacted me because they had PTSD, and they were going to the lab that they were working at. And it was a commercial laboratory, and he had worked there for a number of years, and he'd worked at other commercial laboratories as well. And over time, he just sort of, his ethics got worn down. He didn't see what the purpose of it was. And he was going home every day, and his marriage was suffering, and he was suffering. And he came to me with his story, and he said, I need help. And if I would have turned him away, you know, who else would have listened to him? I mean, who would have been willing to listen to his story openly and compassionately, and see him through? I mean, now he's no, you know, in the few months after I spoke with him, he ended up leaving his very, very lucrative animal research position, and he's now pursuing an entirely different career in microbrewing. And he's, you know, his story, to me, I feel like that's the first success story of the film. It happened before we even finished editing it, because he had this ethical crisis, and we as a crew, and myself as a director, was willing to say, you know, your story is important, your experience is valid. That doesn't mean that I agree with what he's doing, of course not, but we were able to have a dialogue, and he and I exchanged extremely lengthy letters over that time. And, you know, he went into counseling and he left that practice. I mean, he didn't just, you know, sort of leave in a meek way. Like, he left and made it clear to his, you know, to his, superiors why he was leaving, and that he felt like what they were doing was unconscionable, and that they were, you know, that they were just going about things in a totally wrong way. And I mean, not only did he leave the practice, but he shortly after that, you know, I'm friends with him on Facebook, and I see him posting, you know, photos of all these vegan meals that he and his wife are having. And I mean, his life has completely changed since that time. And it's hard for me to look at that story and imagine going about it in a more confrontational way. It's just not, it's not who I am, and it's not how I want to do things. Like, do I want a revolution? Of course. I think, you know, I think the world needs one in a lot of different ways, but I'm not willing to go down the road of, like, so many other revolutions that we've had in the world that have been extremely bloody and extremely, you know, the cost has been extremely high.
Carol, I admire your attitude very much, and I agree with what you've just said. It reminds me of one of my favorite Tom Reagan quotes from his 2011 AR Zone interview. I won't read you the entire quote now because it's quite long, but here's the part that's relevant. He says, "The last thing other animals need is another reason not to care about them. How we act toward other people can provide just such a reason." He goes on to say that he thinks of other humans as mirrors, which I read to suggest that he sees in others a reflection of who he used to be. What you say reminds me of this quote, which I'll link to when we publish your podcast, and that it's a good thing to respect other humans. I mean, humans are animals after all. And I think that the respect you've shown toward those who you may have strongly disagreed with at one time is commendable. So I really thank you for that.
I should really say that this is not, I don't say that as a judgment of other activists. And I recognize that it's difficult. I hope that people who have that critique of the film, which I think is a valid critique, like, well, I think any critique is a valid critique, but, you know, if people have that critique about the film, I hope that they know that it's not easy for me, at times to have that position. And I hope that people recognize as well that, you know, I share their anger. Like, I have watched more graphic footage, you know, for every minute of the film that you see, whether it's, you know, an artistic shot or a shot from inside a laboratory, I have an hour of graphic footage that I've watched, and I feel that anger, and I know where that comes from. It would, you know, the desire for that sort of retribution and vengeance is real. And I think, you know, I can hold both of those things at the same time. I can hold that anger in my heart, but I can also hold compassion in my heart. And it's hard to hold both of those things, but I don't know how else I would go about doing it.
How did you cope with all the graphic footage that you did have to watch?
Well, I'm sure some people close to me would say not well. But I don't know. I mean, I have a very calm life. Like, I don't I'm not like a go out on the weekends kind of person, you know. I share an apartment with a wonderful little cat, and you know, she keeps me company a lot, and I have really good friends who you know when to talk about this stuff and know when to not talk about this stuff. And you know, I play a lot of music, and I listen to stand-up comedy, and I kind of, you know, I mean, I it it's like with anybody who feels these things deeply. I mean, as you both do, you know that, you know, watching really graphic footage is difficult, and knowing what non-human animals collectively and individually go through is, you know, it's a really heavy thing to carry. I don't think that I, you know, I've probably watched more graphic footage than your average activist, but I don't think it's, I think it affects us all in a pretty similar way. I think it leaves wounds, and those wounds are kind of, you know, what propels us forward in a lot of ways. And I'm thankful for that, and it's difficult, and I don't know. It's all kind of messy, but it's just part of doing that work. It's not, you know, I don't feel heroic, and I don't feel different than any, you know, like I remember, you know, being in a room full of people and watching, you know, everyone watching Earthlings, like, you know, everybody was destroyed after that film. So I wasn't any more destroyed than anyone else, and it just kind of, you know, we go forward, we do what we can, and I kind of just do what I can too.
Thank you. Can I ask you about the Open the Cages tour, which you've been involved in? It's a collaborative effort between artists and advocates across the US. The tour also included the first screenings, I believe, of Maximum Tolerated Dose in the US. Can you speak about what the goals of the tour have been and will continue to be? And do you believe that those goals have been accomplished?
That's a really good set of questions, and the reason that I got involved with the Open the Cages tour was because the tour director, Mike XBX, he approached me as the director of the film, and you know, he really wanted to put together something that was unique in the history of animal activism. He wanted to sort of put together this kind of almost like a traveling animal rights festival in a way. You know, there have been in the U.S. there have been some cross-country tours that have involved animal activism, but nothing that also included things like film screenings and music events and that sort of thing. So he wanted to put together something that was sort of multifaceted, and the central goal of all of that was to was obviously to bring light to issues surrounding animal experimentation, but it was also to help to rebuild and motivate the grassroots movements in the different areas that we went to. And it was really interesting being a part of Open the Cages because, you know, as you've both remarked and as many people have remarked, you know, the film is a very open and look at people who have participated in animal experimentation. But I mean, you know, we would have the film screening one day, and the next day we would be going out, all of us would be going out and protesting outside of an animal lab. And I mean, I participated in those protests, and they were loud and they were raucous, and I think that was an amazing balance. You know, we would have really positive conversations about issues raised in the film, and then we would also go out and, you know, and go to the places where animal experimentation happens in those communities and energize people and motivate people and say, like, you know, if you're looking for the place where this happens, this is where it is. So we met a lot of local activists on the tour. We really made an effort in each stop that we went to organize in conjunction with local activists to do things on their terms. And we really wanted to motivate people and show them that, you know, that confronting animal experimentation is possible in their own communities. And I would say, you know, it was successful to varying degrees in different cities. I think probably the city that I've kept the most sort of tabs on and that we've seen the most like the most sort of sharp response in was Reno. We went to Reno. Reno is the home in the U.S. of Charles River Laboratories. Charles River is a huge animal experimentation contractor. They not only do experiments on their premises, but they also breed animals for use in other laboratories. And they have a laboratory like so many laboratories. It's kind of just like, it's very nondescript. It's not in the middle of the city or anything, but it's quite accessible by roads, and it's not hidden very far out. But so we had a protest there. We got really excellent press in response to it, and since then, the local Reno activist community has been holding regular demonstrations at Charles River, and the situation at Charles River, they've had numerous violations of regulations and that sort of thing. It's remained in the news, and that's largely been due to the ongoing efforts of the activists in that community. So I think that, you know, that our visit to Reno was a big success. And I think in other cities it was successful to varying degrees, but, that was sort of the intent, was to create that kind of momentum and to get grassroots activists, excited about doing activism again, perhaps in places where, you know, it's been kind of at a lull for a while.
Carol, given that it's estimated that around about 98% of all the individuals that are exploited by humans are those that are used in the food industry, why do you think it was important that the tour focus mostly on vivisection?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I didn't, the tour wasn't organized by me. It was organized by Mike XVX, and it was his intention to, it was sort of his, I think, vision initially to focus on laboratories. So I think he would probably be better to answer that than I would. I mean, people have asked me why I chose to focus on vivisection in the film. And again, that was more because of a personal motivation as opposed to any sort of like a strategic concern. I think, you know, strategically, if I had made a film about food animals, it probably, in some quantifiable way could save more food animals or something like that. I know that some people like to do that kind of calculus. Never really been the way that I approach what I'm doing. It's, that was the subject of the stories that I was pursuing. So,
yeah, it's not a criticism. I just find it interesting.
I do think it's a valid question, like strategically, but it also was never, that was never part of my decision-making process. The questions about like effectiveness and strategy to me are very interesting, but they're also very, I think a lot of people, we say a lot of things like, well, this would be more effective, or this would be more effective, or it's obvious that this is more effective. But I don't think we ever really actually know.
No, we don't. I agree.
It's that we use to measure effectiveness are like, I don't, when you start to analyze how people calculate effectiveness, it all starts to kind of fall apart to me.
Oh, look, I agree with you. I think a lot of the time we think we know, but I don't think we know either. So I agree with that.
It's not that I like to be quote-unquote effective. I just, I'm not sure what that means all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things in the film that I was particularly interested in, you said that around 80% of all of the individuals who are used in invasive experiments are rats and mice. However, usually when we hear of groups rescuing the victims of vivisection, we usually almost always hear about rescuing dogs, primates, and occasionally rabbits, but rarely do we ever hear about rats or mice being rescued. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, honestly, we never really hear, I mean, we rarely hear about animals and labs being rescued much anymore anyway. And part of that is because I think the security apparatus surrounding labs has really clamped down in the last few years. As technology has gotten better, it's become more difficult for those kind of rescues to happen. I think the recent rescues, like, for example, the Beagle Freedom Project or groups like that who have rescued beagles from labs, I mean, we're not talking about clandestine kind of rescues. We're talking about above ground, like things have been agreed on and that sort of thing. And I mean, the dog rescue that I feature in the film was a clandestine rescue, but I mean, it's rare. It's hard for me to think past that one back to when there was another, you know, really significant rescue of lab animals. It's hard to remember when the last one was. I mean, you know, back in, I think, you know, Keith Mann was involved in a rescue of laboratory mice at one point, and I think I remember when I was doing the radio show that he was interviewed on, you know, he mentioned hearing, I think when he was back in prison, that a bunch of the rats and mice that he had rescued had been recaptured and were back in the laboratory, and that was heartbreaking for him. So, you know, I think that there's some anecdotal stuff that points to that. I mean, I think the crux of your question, though, is more about, you know, it's more about, you know, how we value those different animals. And I think, you know, again, it probably goes back to questions of strategy. I think people can relate more to dogs and primates than they do to mice. And I kind of, you know, I discussed that in the film. You know, part of the reason I think that rats and mice in particular are used to such an extent is that they, you know, they're close enough to us in the sense that they're mammals, but we can kind of separate ourselves from them enough that you don't feel bad testing about them. Public opinion also, you know, is divided along those lines. If you ask the general public if they think a particular experiment should go forward, you know, their level of acceptance will depend on whether it's a dog or a rat or a primate or a rat. I think part of it probably also has to do with who are the non-human animals who are the easiest to sort of, you know, to sort of like make disappear afterwards, you know, like it's, dogs are very adoptable, whereas, you know, primates, it's very difficult to find an appropriate home for a primate. And with rats and mice, you know, they're just, people are less inclined to take them. They're not as common as companion animals. And so I think, you know, in many ways, I think those rescues of dogs make more, you know, more sense from a logistical standpoint. You know, activists can make them disappear afterwards quicker, I think.
Yeah, I can understand that perspective. I think it's unfortunate, but I can understand that. There was something else in the film that I found a little bit troubling while I was listening to it. Of the people that were speaking, almost every time anybody spoke about other animals, they referred to those individuals as it. Do you think the language we use when referring to others can reinforce our speciesism and even an indoctrination that leads us to think that other animals are commodities?
I mean, I do think the language is important when, you know, when I'm discussing other animals. You know, I always make an effort to use, you know, he or she or those types of pronouns, I guess, I guess they're called. you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it's also just part of it's part of the culture to just refer to animals as it. It's kind of like it's just how they speak about them. Like, to give you a different example, like my dad always refers to my cat as he, even though he's a she. But my dad's Polish, and so the sort of, like, culturally they always refer to animals to cats as he, and so he just has a hard time calling her she, even though that's who she is. And so I think those cultural things are really hard to shake. I know that that's kind of, your question is a bit more has a bit more political implications than that, and I think those political implications are real. I'm not sure the extent to which that language, I think the language is important. I'm just not sure to what extent that. I think the person who I can think of who, and I won't name them, but the person in the film who I think of who uses it the most to me is someone who's like a hardcore vegan, and like, you know, she just really has, like, you know, I just, it's, she's already quote unquote there in a way. But that language still sticks culturally. So, I'm not sure the extent to which it's, those things go together.
Yeah. It's very difficult to change. I know people that are very against using words like it and things like that, but you know, sometimes, like you said, it's very difficult to be aware of it all the time.
Yeah. I don't want to correct people either.
No, that's
right. You know, the interviews happen in a much more kind of free-flowing way, and I often let people just talk at length, and then it became sort of an editing nightmare later. But yeah.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I don't for a second think that there was anything that you could have done about it. I mean, that I don't think, yeah, no, it wouldn't have been appropriate for you to be correcting people.
Yeah, it would have probably been interesting to have those conversations, and I think that conversation is an interesting one to have, and it took me forever to sort of adjust my own use of language. And I think when you mention it to people, it's very eye-opening for them, but that was never how our conversations went.
I understand. In the film, you documented how macaques are kidnapped from the jungles of Southeast Asia. The film shows what they endure as they're stolen from their homes to be used for commercial breeding and research purposes. Their journey is absolutely horrible, and many don't even make it out of Southeast Asia alive. However, the humans who are actually doing the stealing are living really quite difficult lives, just trying to keep themselves and their families alive. I'm not for a second excusing what these people do, but when we consider that those who are reaping the most profit from the enterprise are not these people, these people are being paid as little as, from what I've read, $15 per macaque, while others are getting rich from this. Aren't these people often oppressed and exploited themselves by the very same system? And how do we address these type of issues in a realistic way?
So myself and my crew, we visited Southeast Asia in late 2011, and the footage that you see, so there's, in that sequence that you're talking about, there's the trapping footage, and then there's a bunch of footage of monkey farms. So the trapping footage was actually captured by colleagues of ours who were working for the BUAV 1 year previous, and we returned to that part of the world in 2011 explore monkey farming a bit further. So that's where the farming footage is more recent, and it's been kind of spliced together to create a whole picture. The the reactions to that part of the film have been interesting because I don't think anybody... I expected to, in the same way that, you know, people have an extremely kind of angry reaction towards people who perform animal experiments, I really expected people to have a really visceral kind of reaction to the people doing the trapping. It's a really, I mean, I think it's the most sort of visceral part of the film, and people react audibly to it. Like, it's very difficult for people to watch, even though it's not quote-unquote graphic. And the interesting thing about it, though, is that it hasn't been, the reactions to it haven't been, I haven't heard a lot from people that said, like, oh, those people who trapped the monkeys are the scum of the earth or anything like that. I think people have generally recognized that they're at the bottom of a very steep economic pyramid that ends at you know, contract laboratories and university laboratories who use macaque monkeys. And to give the listeners a quick sense of what that industry looks like, macaque monkeys are trapped in all over Southeast Asia, specifically in Thailand and Malaysia and Cambodia. They're trapped in the wild. They're sent to Laos, usually over the land border between Cambodia and Laos. In Laos, they're bred in large sort of factory farm facilities. They're bred in the hundreds and in the thousands. And then those farms are actually owned by Chinese and Vietnamese companies. And so monkeys are essentially laundered. They're sent through China and Vietnam. They're given new, you know, identities, and they're essentially made to look like they've originated from China and Vietnam, because there are, you know, there are some international regulations about the trade in these species. And those Chinese and Vietnamese companies then, you know, sell them to companies in Europe and in North America, and increasingly now, you know, to large labs in India and places like that. So the people who are, you know, in the boats trapping the monkeys are, yeah, as you said, that's pretty close to what we discovered as well. They're, you know, they're making maybe, you know, $10 to $15 per monkey. When we were doing our undercover investigation, I was posing as an animal dealer, and the price that was quoted to me for animals directly from Laos would have been somewhere between anywhere between $250 to $600 per monkey.
Wow.
If I were to buy them from the Chinese and Vietnamese companies as opposed to buying directly from the farmers, I probably would have been looking at somewhere between, you know, $1,000 to $1,500 per monkey. So, you know, it's not any different than other industries that have been globalized in that way. I mean, not that it's not quite the same thing, but for a sneaker that costs 15 cents to produce in a sweatshop, you know, we pay $100 for them over here. And I mean, having been to Southeast Asia and to Laos specifically, where that farming happens, I mean, life is cheap there. Not just non-human life, you know, human life is cheap there. You can buy a child if you want a child. I mean, it's an extremely hard life there, and people do to get by. I mean, it's the same reason why, you know, why people work in sweatshops. They don't work there because it's a great job. It's the same reason people work in slaughterhouses. I mean, they don't work there because it's a great job and they're making tons of money. It's because they're at the bottom of the heap. So it was difficult at times meeting the farmers, because some of the farmers were quite wealthy, and that was obvious to me, and they wore their wealth quite garishly, but I didn't really, it was hard to muster anger towards, you know, the people working in the farms who, you know, oftentimes live on the farms, and they sort of have dormitories there, and it's not, they're not, I wouldn't say they're profiting in like the classical way that we think of profit.
When people are reduced to the point where they'll sell their own children, then they're not, it's not really a heck of a lot different than slavery, you know. And I think it's difficult for people. I know it is for me. I mean, I've lived in the United States all my life. I lived in Canada for a couple of years, but it's difficult for me to imagine what it is to live in a world like that. It's not even conceivable really to me, because it's so foreign to my experience. So it's just, you know, I think what Carolyn's question and your answer bring out is how we talk about animal exploitation, and Carolyn mentioned in another question that she asked, you know, humans are animals too, and are being exploited in some terrible, terrible ways all over the planet. It can be disheartening to think about.
Mm-hmm. And I don't. This is kind of, may seem like an odd comparison to make, and I recognize that there are different economic issues at play, but I mean, the people who work in laboratories too, I mean, that section of, you know, the labor is stratified there as well. So you have the people who are actually, you know, getting the grant funding and designing the studies and doing that stuff. I mean, they rarely see the animals. It's, you know, you may have like a principal investigator or somebody who's designing the studies who's very hands-on and wants to see what's happening. But one of the things that I talk about in the film is how labor is stratified there. And so the people who are working in labs and working with the animals, they often are doing that because they are good with animals and they like working with animals and they like, you know, being around animals. And it's not until they get there that they realize more of what it is they're going to be doing. And I think sometimes in an academic context, it's a bit different, and the people who are designing the studies have a bit more contact, but it really depends on the situation. You know, I think the people who end up doing the work in Western research labs, you know, they go through a process of training where they're indoctrinated into thinking that what they're doing is okay, and it's not I'm not trying to compare it to the lives of people who are, you know, in small boats in Cambodia trapping monkeys. It's an entirely different life, but it's, you know, they also are telling themselves a story about why what they're doing is okay. And when your career and your research and your, you know, the money that you use to feed your family is at stake, you'll tell yourselves all kinds of stories to justify what you're doing. I mean, some of the people in the film talk about that. You know, it's not just, if only it were so easy about what was right and wrong. It's not just about that. It's about your whole, you know, it's about your entire life. It's about your identity. It's about your life. It's about, you know, how you provide for your family. It's all of those things. All of those things weigh on the ethical decisions that people have to make.
Absolutely. Yeah, if only it were so easy, like you said, to decide what was right and wrong, but it's not. Absolutely, I agree.
One of the things that we talk about a lot is the idea of advocacy opening up a conceptual space for people to see themselves in a life, in a world that isn't the one that they've been handed. And I think that it's easy to forget how much of what we do every day we just do because it's the world and the life that we've been handed. And if if people can see beyond that, you know, in a way that isn't threatening to their identity, in a way that gives them the opportunity to envision a different sort of life in a different sort of world, I think that's when change starts to happen. It's just damn tough to do that.
Yeah, and but, it's really hard to open up a space where we can make that happen. I mean, it's genuinely really difficult to make space for people to make changes, not just related to animal rights stuff, to any, you know, to any kind of social justice issue. I think, you know, it's people have to overcome guilt about things that they've done in the past. They need to see like positive ways forward. They need to know that, you know, that they'll have that they'll have a community who supports them. They'll need to know, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that have to be in place for change to happen. And it's really tough. Like, it's like you're saying, it's damn tough to create those conditions to where change can take place.
So now I'm going to ask you the Ronnie question. Ronnie Lee is one of our admins, and he's not here to ask the question himself, so I'll ask it in his place. What was it that caused you to become vegan and to decide to spend so much of your efforts and energy on behalf of other animals?
Well, part of what inspired me to become vegan was also part of what inspired me to make the film. But I went vegetarian in 2001. After going to see a punk rock show by a band called Propaganda, and they were really fundamental to me sort of having a whole bunch of political awakenings in high school, but I was always kind of resistant to their animal rights message. And after seeing them live, I was like, well, that's the end of that. And I was still very much sort of invested in eggs and dairy products. And it wasn't until I started working on the Animal Voices radio show, which is a radio show based out of Toronto, that I sort of decided. The host at the time, Lauren Corman, who's a professor of critical animal studies at Brock, she really encouraged me to get involved. She knew that I was passionate about the issues. And I kind of just, you know, I, it seemed ridiculous to get involved with an animal rights radio show if I wasn't vegan. So, that was, sort of a turning point for me. And, that was really, yeah, I know that that kind of, it sounds almost incidental, but at the time, you know, I had seen, you know, films like Peaceable Kingdom and I was thinking about it, but I needed that kind of push, and I was already kind of pretty much there. I wasn't really consuming dairy and eggs that much, but I still needed that sort of extra motivation. So it was kind of I felt like I was being being a part of the radio show, that was, you know, my card was being pulled and I had to kind of like put up or shut up. And, you know, through that radio show and through Lauren's work and her ongoing work, in critical animal studies, she introduced me to the perspective of valuing workers' perspectives as a form of activism, and that could also be a part of animal rights, and that it didn't make sense to demonize slaughterhouse workers, for example, or something like that. So, I mean, working with her on that radio show was really fundamental to going vegan and to getting more involved in animal activism in general. And also it's really informed how I approach the film. So all of it kind of stems back to that in a lot of ways.
What can our listeners do to become part of a campaign to end the use of other animals in medical and scientific experimentation? Is there something that you can recommend kind of as a general matter?
It's been really interesting because at different screenings at different times I've been asked this, and I generally, even though, you know, we did discuss, you know, questions of strategy a little bit earlier, I've generally kind of shied away from offering too much advice when it comes to activism. I think it's kind of, although I do consider myself an activist, I think generally speaking, it's, these questions are so individual. I think everybody has different sort of, everyone has different skills and everyone has different comfort zones, and the kind of activism and campaign that you get involved in is largely going to be, I think it's largely going to be affected by those individual questions. So it's hard to give a general kind of advice, but I think that, you know, I always suggest to people to read their history books, and in a lot of cases in animal rights, that means going back to, you know, short run zines and very small independent publications that have been passed around sort of through word of mouth and, you know, literally from one hand to another, and to kind of to get an understanding of the kind of activism that's already been, because I think, you know, we're often so intent on looking forward that we don't really look back at what has worked and what hasn't worked. And so I always encourage people to read up on the history of the movement. A really great place to do that right now is a website called Conflict Gypsy that has a whole bunch of animal liberation zines from years gone by, and quite a lot of that has focused on animal experimentation. So I encourage people to look at that stuff. I also encourage people to just try and get tapped into what's going on locally. In the U.S., in North America, there's a really interesting website, and this kind of goes back to Tim's question about reading things you disagree with. There's a really interesting website called PubMed, P-U-B-M-E-D, like public medicine, but just PubMed.com. And if people go to that website, they can look up the kind of research that's being done at different institutions. And there's a whole bunch of, you know, it's a search engine, so you can look up the kind of research that's been published from an institution that's in your area and find out what kind of research has been done on what kind of animals, and see what you're up against, essentially. You can advocate on behalf of lab animals in general, and I think that's one way to go about it. But I think that, you know, there's all kinds of creative activism that can be done when you know about more specific information about what goes on in different laboratories, and that's one of the ways that that the folks in Reno have been able to really put pressure on Charles River, is that they have found out of a very specific horrific incidences that have happened at that laboratory. It's helped to get that issue into the media a lot more. And everywhere where people are is going to have a different scene and different groups and different things going on. But, you know, people may not want to get involved in groups, or they may want to start their own. It all depends on the individual context. But I guess those are a couple of just general points.
That's some great advice. Thank you. Is it possible, and if so, how would somebody go about getting a copy of your film to show in their own communities? And particularly, is it possible to do that outside of the US or Canada?
So we're in the process right now of securing TV distribution, and the TV version of the film is going to be probably a good 10 or 12 minutes shorter than the theatrical version. So it is going to be different, but it'll reach a different audience. And if people want to show the film in their town, we stopped booking for December, but we will sort of pick that up again in the new year. Where the film's been submitted to a bunch of film festivals, and unfortunately, one of the ways that film festivals work is that often a lot of them have sort of they call them sort of premiere exceptions. So, for example, if I wanted to show the film in the UK at a X, Y, or Z film festival, that would have to be like the UK premiere. We've been holding off on doing screenings in certain areas because of that. But as the acceptance or rejection letters, so we'll have a better sense of when we can just, you know, open up the screenings to whomever. But people can contact us at maximumtoleratedose@gmail.com. Had a bunch of people try to contact us through our Facebook page, which is great, and we get to it eventually. But if people wanted a quicker response, our Gmail address is the best way to reach us. And we will... if we're not organizing screenings in your part of the world just yet, we'll put you on our screening list, and we'll get in touch with you as soon as that's able to happen.
Fantastic. If people wanted to help out financially, would they use the same email address? Is there something that they can do?
We're not. We've been fortunate, you know, in recent months to, for example, to get the Lush Prize and that sort of thing. So our sort of fundraising campaign is over, and I'd much prefer that, you know, people donate their funds. I know that everywhere funds are scarce, and I'd much rather people donate their funds to places that have a more specific need for them right now. We're wanting to put together a really nice DVD package that will... you know, that we'll probably do in a limited run, and then we'll do, we want to eventually have the film on YouTube, but that will be likely in 2014. And, we'd like to make the film available as well for a reasonably priced, you know, $2 or $3 or $5 download as well. So there'll be multiple ways for people to access the film as it goes on, but, we don't need funding at this point. And, people can save their pennies for now.
That's very generous of you. Carol, it's been our pleasure to be speaking with you today. I just want to thank you so much for being here and for everything that you've been doing, and even for your attitude in general. I think it's marvelous. But before we say goodbye, is there anything you'd like to mention that we've not covered? And can you please let us know if there are any projects that are coming up for you that we've not spoken about?
There's another project that I'm working on now that's sort of in its very infancy stages. It's not related to animal rights, but it is another documentary that will deal with a social justice issue. I mean, that I think will also be relevant to animal rights activists. So that will, being so cryptic, but that will just, anyway, yeah, that will come later. I guess the main thing that I haven't really spoken about, but that I would like to mention is, you know, something sort of I was reminded of when you're asking contribute financially. I think, you know, I was so fortunate in sort of launching the film project to have the support of the community in and around Toronto, not just in Toronto, but, you know, support from really all corners of the world. And when people heard about the film and they saw the initial sort of work we did into creating a trailer for the film, they really showed a lot of support, and it's hard to mention this stuff without it just sounding like kind of, you know, I'm listing I know it sounds kind of cliche, but just the amount of support that we received from the Toronto community really helped to propel a zero dollar budget film into being a real thing. And then it allowed us to move forward when we didn't have sort of institutional funding to create what we have. And later on, we were able to get some arts funding to complete the film. And it was really a humbling experience when we did the Toronto screening of the film. So many of the people who had supported the film with, you know, a $20 donation here or a $50 donation there, you know, so many of those people came out and got to see what we had been working on. And it was a really moment. And I really hope that people know, you know, when they see these like Kickstarter campaigns and they see people really, you know, struggling to make their ideas happen, I hope that people know that their actions do make a difference. And we really wouldn't have done it without that kind of support. So thank you to everyone who made that happen.
That's fantastic, Carol. I just want to thank you again for being here, and particularly for everything that you do. I think that you're making a wonderful difference. And so, yeah, thank you. And thank you for your visit to AR Zone.
It was really awesome speaking with you both. It's, you know, interviews are so difficult because you often get asked questions that are very similar to questions that you know. But I really feel like I touched on a bunch of new stuff. And I'm really looking forward to having people listen and maybe learn some things about the film they didn't know before.
Yeah, look, it really has. Like, I often say that, well, for me, it's a pleasure to speak with every single guest that we have in AR Zone. I think that they're all doing amazing work and they're wonderful people. But, you know, it really has been a pleasure to speak with you. I feel like all I've said the whole time is I agree with that. But I really have. I think that the work you're doing is amazing.
Maybe it's because I'm a bit too agreeable.
Yeah, that's terrible.
I don't know. I'm sure that people who are listening right now will, hopefully some people out there will disagree with what I've said. And if they want to contact me, then that they can do that at the maximum tolerated dose address too. I'm not promising any lengthy responses, but I will, you know, I read everything that goes in there and I'm always open to discussion. So, you know, I think dialogue has become like it's become a lost art in activism in general and in animal rights in particular. So it's always, as I kind of said in that other interview, if people disagree, like, let's hear it. I'm open to having that conversation.
Absolutely. It's a good thing. I learn more from speaking with people that I disagree with than I do from speaking with people that hold the same positions that I do. Like,
yeah. And on that note, I'll end the interview maybe on a kind of an odd one. If people want to check out the latest sort of cutting edge propaganda from the animal research industries, they should check out the website and the Facebook page for the Foundation for Biomedical Research, which is an organization based in the US. They're doing some incredibly odd and fascinating propaganda work on behalf of animal experimentation. And I think it's just something that activists don't see very often, and when they do, they just kind of shut down. But it's super, super interesting, and I don't want to be so arrogant as to think that I've had an effect on them, but I think that the Foundation for Biomedical Research is even producing its own film right now that features, you know, the individual stories of people who have been helped by animal research, which is what. Weird, and I think they have a trailer that's up for it as well. And I watched it, and I was just thinking, like, I don't really understand what's going on right now. It was really weird. I expected something a bit more slick, but anyway, it's strange. People should go check it out. It's you know, that's their world. That's the world that they live in. We need to know about it.
Exactly, we do need to know about it. Yeah. Thank you again, Carol, so much.
No problem. It's been a really great conversation. I was really, really happy to have it.
Thank you for listening to AR Zone. Please visit us online at www.arzone.net and look for us on iTunes.